One of the jobs that I have in our home, in which I take great delight, is the job of official jar opener. My name is Frank. I'm the preacher here at South Lansing Christian Church. I'd like to join Wally in welcoming you. I'm really glad you're here today. Official jar opener. From time to time, my wife, who is lovely and wonderful, will come to me and she'll say, "I can't open this jar." Or more often than that, she'll just summon me to the kitchen, and because I'm a dutiful man, I'll come to the kitchen, right? And she'll say, "I can't open this jar," and she'll hand it to me. And this is when I kind of go into my shtick, you know? I'm like, I don't know. Ooh, it's a big jar. Ooh, it's stuck on there. This is going to require superhuman strength. Can he do it? Yes, he can. That's just how I roll, right? It's pretty closely official jar opener. How many of you, by the way, are official jar openers in your own home, right? You know what I'm talking about. Manly men, and we open jars. That's what we do. It's pretty closely related to the job of official Weller Family Rescue Dad, which I have held that position out for a number of years. Several years ago, my daughter called me. It was late at night. It was 10 o'clock at night. She had a flat tire. So I jumped into the phone booth and I put on my shirt with the big D for Dad and my cape and I jetted. I was talking to a lady from our church the other day and I was telling her this story and she said, "Yeah, I called my dad," and he said, "Spares in the tires, or spares in the trunk, see you when you get home." I'm like, so she learned how to change a tire. My daughter didn't. Here's the truth though. Here's the truth. There are a lot of things in this world that I can't fix. Right? And I'll bet you're there with me. Maybe I can open a jar. You know, maybe I can change a spare tire. But there are a lot of things in this world, in my family, that I'm just powerless to fix. When my wife, several years ago, she was fighting a serious illness, very serious illness. Nothing I could do about it. I could pray for her. I could support her. But I couldn't fix the situation. When my daughter got her heart broken by a boy, I couldn't fix the situation. I wanted to fix the situation, you know what I'm talking about, right? But I couldn't fix the situation. She needed a dad, not a felon. When my son didn't make the starting lineup, right? Powerless to fix that situation. When I lost my job one time, 6 weeks before Christmas, and we had a baby that had just been born in August, our second. Powerless. I couldn't fix that. Well, we were looking at moving in with family. I mean, it was that, we were in dire straits. There have been plenty of times in my life where I have been absolutely powerless to fix what was going on in my life. And I'm guessing you've had those moments too, because those moments are part of the human experience. You've had moments where you've been in a situation where you needed help. You couldn't fix it. Maybe you were powerless to figure out how to fix it. Maybe you knew how to fix it, but you didn't have the resources to fix it. Now, many of those times, it might have been, you know, something insignificant. You know, something so insignificant as loosening the lid. You had to wait until somebody got home. Right? You know, you couldn't fix the situation. It wasn't a serious situation, but you couldn't fix it. But there have been a lot of times, probably in your life, certainly in my life, where you can't fix the damage, and the damage is serious. You lost your job. You failed out of school. She filed for divorce. Chapter 13. A child's rebellion. Every one of us have had those moments in life where we were powerless to fix our circumstances. And as we explore this idea of finding your way back to God, we're learning about five awakenings that each one of us have. Yes, finding your way back to God is a moment, but it's also a process. And in that process, we experience five awakenings. We've already talked about two of those. A few weeks ago, we talked about this awakening to longing, this desire that we have for something more. There must be something more. And so we begin to long, you know, maybe we're longing for meaning, or we're longing for love, or we're longing for a purpose, but we long for something more. And so many times We go looking for that, to fulfill that longing in places that aren't healthy and that aren't good for us. And eventually we find ourselves awakening to regret. We wake up one day in a place that we never thought we would be, and we ask ourselves, how did we get here? We realize we've blown it, and we long for a fresh start. And once that happens, for many of us, we awaken to help. We realize, I am in a circumstance that I am powerless to fix on my own. I cannot figure this out on my own. And we awaken for this desire for help. We realize we need help. We've been in Luke chapter 15 these last couple weeks, and we're going to be there again today. We met a young man who's experienced these awakenings. A couple weeks ago, we learned that he awakened to longing. He just longed for something more. Like many of us, he looked at his circumstances, he didn't like where he was, and he longed for something more. We read about him in Luke chapter 15, verse 11. There was a man who had two sons. The younger said to his father, "Father, give me my share of the estate." So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to his field to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. Here's a young man who awakened to this longing, this sense that there must be something more. Whether it was a longing for love or meaning or purpose, we're not sure exactly what he was missing in his life, but he felt like there must be something more. And so he did this extreme radical thing. He went to his father. He said, "Father, divide your estate. Give me my inheritance." And then he went off in search of love or meaning or purpose to some land far away. And eventually, this young man experienced what each of us has to experience on our way back to God. He awakened to regret. He woke up one day and he found himself in a pigsty feeding pigs, really so hungry that he was longing for what they were eating, and he asked himself, "How did I get here?" Verse 17 says, "When he came to his senses," that's awakening to regret. The young man came to his senses and he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare? And here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, 'Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.' So he got up and went to his father." If we could just sort of walk along with that young man for a little bit this morning. If we could just, you know, tag along with him, maybe beside or maybe behind him. What I really want us to do is just watch that young man on his journey home today. Can you imagine the reception that he anticipated? Can you imagine what he expected to find on his return home? I imagine that with each step he took, this young man's sense of dread began to grow. What would his parents' reaction be? You know, the first time they laid eyes on him, when they saw him, would their countenance fall? Would their face turn to a stony, cold glare as they turned around and walked away? How bad, maybe, would the scolding be? And would his father actually agree to take him on as a servant? It's interesting that we actually do know what the son expected. We know enough about the Palestinian culture in his day to know the sort of reception that this young man anticipated. There was actually a ceremony that the ancient Jews had that fit this particular circumstance. It was called the kezaza. Kezaza. Fun word to say, right? Not a fun experience. And this ceremony took place any time a child left his parents and decided to go and live among the godless Gentiles and then later return. This young man would expect that upon his return, he would be met at the entrance to the village or at the city gates by the townspeople who would gather together. There they would confront this young man. They would bring with them a large pot, probably much larger than this. They would bring with them a large pot, and there in front of the young man, they would cast the pot down, breaking it, shattering it into pieces, and they would tell him, "You have broken our community. Therefore, you have been cut off from us, never to return." And just as those shards of clay lay at his feet, never to be reassembled into a functional working pot once again, this young man would realize, "I can never go back. I can never be a part of the community again." So naturally, the son avoided going home just as long as he could, right? Because he knew what was waiting. He knew that when he went back, he could no longer be a part of his people. He could no longer be a... The best he could hope for was that maybe they would take him in as a slave, as a servant. That maybe he could at least have food in his belly and a roof over his head. But never again would he be a son. Never again would he be a citizen of that community. Because those hopes would be dashed to the ground just like a broken pot. And so naturally, starvation, alienation, they were preferable to the shame and humiliation that he expected when he returned home. And so as long as possible, he decided to put off this kizaza ceremony. It's interesting. The son also knew that not only did this ceremony await him, but he knew that he had to be the one to make the first move. He knew that he had to be the father hadn't moved. The father had stayed at home. The son needed to return to the father. In fact, he knew, growing up in this culture as he did, he knew what to expect. He knew that the father, as the patriarch of the family, was expected to sit and wait at the house. When he returned home on the day of the kizaza, on the day of the ceremony, the father would not be present. He would not go and meet his son. He would not participate in the breaking of that pot and the ceremonial breaking of the community. The father would not do that. He would sit at home. He would wait for his son to come to him. The mother, on the other hand, it was acceptable for her to go to the son. It was acceptable that prior to this ceremony, she could maybe run a little bit. She could hurry her way to the site of the ceremony, and she could shower kisses upon her son before that pot was broken, before he was cut off. Not the father. The father would wait. In this culture, the father never runs. To do so would be undignified, even contemptible. This is what the son expects on his return home. With every step, his sense of foreboding grows. He knows it's going to be awful. But that's not what happened. Verse 20 tells us what actually happened. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to him, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. And the actual Greek there, the way it's translated, it means he kissed him over and over and over again. He showered kisses upon his son. This patriarch, this dignified father, ran. It was unheard of. I mean, can you imagine a CEO running across the boardroom to, greet one of his subordinates? Can you imagine a president, a chief of state, running across, the South Lawn to greet someone who is a subordinate? The father literally would have had to hike up his robes, right? They wore long robes, and in a culture where modesty was valued and you never showed your ankle, the father would have had to hike up his robes to run to the son. But he didn't care about any of that. Day after day, I picture the Father scanning the horizon, waiting for the Son to return, praying that the Son would return. And when the Father sees him, the Father knows what's going to happen too. It's not just the Son who's expecting the kizaza to take place. It's the Father who's also expecting that ceremony. He knows what's going to happen. He knows that the village people are going to meet his Son. They're going to cast down a pot. They're going to cast him out of the community, and he will be a pariah for the rest of his life. And the Father knows, I've got to stop that. And so he hikes up his robes and he runs to the edge of the town. And before his Son can hear the words, "You are cut off from us," the Father embraces him and showers him with kisses and welcomes him back into the family. And after a patriarch, after a dignified man has done something so undignified to rescue his Son from humiliation and shame, who would the townspeople be to go against what the Father has demonstrated? Let me ask you something. Do you understand that this is the God who loves you? Do you understand that the Father in this story represents a God who loves you so much that when you come to the point where you've blown it, you've absolutely blown it, and you are filled with regret, and you realize that you need help. Do you realize that this is the God that we serve, who's looking for you to return home, who comes running to you to spare you the humiliation of rejection and shame? This is the Father who comes and he embraces you and gives you acceptance and showers you with kisses and with tears of joy. Whenever I think about this Father running to his Son, it reminds me of the story of Olympic athlete Derek Richmond, who ran in the 1992 Barcelona Games, an athlete from Great Britain. He was one of his country's preeminent runners, but he'd been plagued throughout his career by injury. And in fact, just 4 months before the Barcelona Olympics, he had torn his Achilles tendon. But he had mended, he was healthy, and for the first time in his life, he was going to be able to participate in the Olympics at full strength. He was incredibly excited. He won his first race, the first heat, easily. He posted his fastest time of the Olympics at that race. And so he made it into the semis. And the semis, he was expecting to cruise to an easy qualification for the finals. The start went smoothly. He was running maybe the best ever in his career until about 150 meters into the race when his hamstring tore, shredded, and he pulled up lame. But it was the Olympics, and he was determined that he was going to finish the race. And so, picking himself up from the ground where he'd fallen, he began to hobble forward toward the finish line. It was at that point that one of the most touching things in Olympic history took place, and I want to share it with you this morning. Let's watch. The man who ran to help was Derek Richmond's father. Here's the thing. I have no idea who won the gold medal in the Barcelona 400-meter race. I have no idea. But this image of a father running to his son is forever etched into my memory. And I want you to get this. That's the kind of God, that's the kind of father that you have. When you've blown the race and you've come up hobbling, you're lying there on the track, you get back up and you begin to limp forward. This is the Father, this is the Heavenly Father that you serve, who comes to you and lifts you and drapes your arm around his shoulder and says, come on, we'll finish this together. That's the God that we serve. It's interesting. We don't just learn about God from the Father in this story. I mean, we learn a lot about God from the Father, but we also learn about God from the storyteller. You know, we think that there are three characters, you know, four characters. There's the Father, there's the Son, there's the younger son, but there's a fourth character. There's the narrator of the story. There's the storyteller. And listen, your most important step in this awakening to help isn't just to meet the father in the story. Your most important step in awakening to help is to meet the narrator. He has a name. His name is Jesus. And the whole reason Jesus told you and I this story was so that we could find our way back to God. And the reason Jesus knows so much about finding your way back to God is because Jesus is God. He's not some distant God who's out there, who just sort of wound up the earth and then set it on its orbit and stays back a safe distance. He is the God who comes to us. He is the God who actively comes into our situation, into our world. He is the God who longs to be close to you. Hundreds of years before Jesus came to this earth, before he told this story, before Luke wrote this story down, there was an ancient prophet who predicted that Jesus would come. Isaiah wrote these words, "The Lord himself will give you a sign. Look, the virgin will conceive a child. She will give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel," which means God is with us. You see, God wrote himself into your story, and he wrote himself into my story. God writes himself into our stories by coming in the person of Jesus. And if you want to know what kind of God we serve, if you want to know what kind of Father loves you, you can find out in the person of Jesus. We have a God who has promised that he will never leave you on your own. You can always call upon him. We have a God who is full of grace. And when we come to him and ask for forgiveness, he will give us acceptance and forgiveness and not condemnation. We have a God who is humble, who bends down into our existence to meet our needs and to come and live among us. We have a God who is for you, who sacrifices himself when you are helpless to save yourself. Help has a name, and that name is Jesus. 2 weeks ago, when we began this series, we asked you to wager something. We asked you to wager a prayer. You remember that? We said, hey, there's a prayer we want you to begin praying for the next 30 days. And here's the deal. You know, you've got nothing to lose and you've got everything to gain. And so we asked you to begin praying, God, if you are real, make yourself real to me. And I'm guessing if you've been praying that prayer for the last 2 weeks, if you've been praying every day, God, if you're real, make yourself real to me, that by now you're beginning to see some things in your life and you're beginning to think, is this from God? Because when we ask God to make himself real to us, he will make himself known to you. And maybe he's making himself known to you right now. And you've realized that you need to come to him for help. You cannot fix your life on your own. It's beyond do-it-yourself repair. You need help. And as you've been praying that prayer these last 2 weeks, maybe you've finally come to the place where you've awakened to help. And so you need to come to Jesus. Let me ask you, what's stopping you? What's stopping you from coming to Jesus for help? Maybe it's your shame. You're just embarrassed. You've been living on some far-off country, you know, wild, extravagant living. You've been searching for love. You've been searching for meaning. You've been searching for purpose, but you've been looking in all these wrong places, and so you're far from God. And maybe it's a sense of shame that's keeping you from coming to him for help. Maybe it's your pride, right? Oh, I can do it on my own. I'm self-reliant. I can stand on my own 2 feet, pull my boots up by my bootstraps. Maybe it's your pride that's keeping you from admitting that you need to come to him for help. And so you've been living all this time, this self-imposed kizaza, having cut yourself off from God, cut yourself off from the community, cut yourself off from help, telling yourself, I can't go home. Here's the truth that the devil doesn't want you to understand today. You can always go home. Because there is a God who right now stands far off, scanning the horizon, looking for you to return. He took on your shame. He bore your humiliation to the cross. And there is nothing standing between you and him except your willingness to say, I need help. And so I'd invite you to extend that prayer wager just a little bit today. Maybe you've been praying, God, if you're real, make yourself real to me. Maybe not, but I'd invite you today to continue to pray, God, if you're real, make yourself real to me. And then add to it this, awaken in me the willingness to return to you for help. Could you begin doing that? Could you begin praying that prayer? God, if you're real, make yourself real to me. Awaken in me the willingness to return to you for help. If you're ready to make that commitment today, I want to give you the opportunity to do so. There are a couple of documents scattered in chairs throughout the room. There's one, there's enough for everybody to have one of each. So just kind of grab one. You might have to reach in the row in front of you or the row behind you to get one. And if you can't reach one now, grab one, you know, in just a little bit when we get up and move around. If God is awakening in you today the willingness to help, the first thing I want to point you to is this little card right here. Next week, we're going to have the opportunity for baptisms in our gathering. Maybe you're ready to take your faith public. Maybe for the first time, God has made himself real to you, and you're ready to say, I'm willing to publicly acknowledge that I need help, and that help has a name, and that name is Jesus. Throughout history, when men and women have awakened to help and they've come to Christ and said, I need you, the way that they publicly proclaim their faith in Jesus is by being baptized in water. And maybe that's where you're at today. Maybe it's time for you to go public with your faith and to be baptized. And if so, I'd encourage you to fill this little card out. Maybe it's time for you to surrender again. You've walked with Jesus for a long time, but then you walked away. He never moved. He stayed right there, but you walked away to some far distant land, and it's time for you to return. And maybe you could let us know that today so that we can pray for you by simply checking that box, I'm willing to surrender again. You know what? If you want to return to Jesus today, or if you want to come to Christ for the first time, I really would be delighted for you to fill this out. And during our communion time, in just a minute, find someone wearing a blue lanyard and hand this to them. And just let them pray with you for just a moment. And then we'll contact you this week about your decision. There's another way that you can experience help. If you've awakened to help this morning, you said, I can't do it on my own, I need help, I invite you to plug into one of our small groups here at South. And these booklets are scattered throughout the room. Afterward, you can stop back at the kiosk where it says small groups in the back of the room, and someone from our small groups ministry would be delighted to talk with you about the different opportunities that you have to be discipled and to grow in your faith. There's over 20 opportunities meeting every day of the week here at the church building and in homes throughout the community where you can plug in with other people and say, I can't do this on my own. I need siblings. I need brothers and sisters around me to help. During our time of communion, we invite you to come to the Jesus that we've talked about today. We invite you to say, I can't do this on my own, Lord. I need you. Here's the beautiful thing. Jesus has already prepared the way. He's already taken on your shame. He's already taken on your humiliation. And he took it to the cross. So this morning, as we eat a little bit of bread and drink a little bit of juice that remind us of his broken body and his shed blood, we can come home. Let's pray. Father, thank you for providing a way for us to come home to you today. I know there are people in this room today, Lord, some who desperately want to return home to you, but their sense of shame is getting in the way. I thank you for taking our shame so that we can be reconciled to you, so that we can be one with you. If there are people who are experiencing that today, Lord, would you give them the courage to just come to you and to pray with one of our leaders here at the church to find a home, to find their way back to you. Lord, there are some who, because of pride, are saying, I don't need help, I can do this on my own, but we know that's not true. And so would you help us to overcome our pride and to come to you and say, walk with me. I need your help, Jesus. As we celebrate the victory that we can have because of Jesus' death on the cross, Lord, help us to lay down whatever stands between us and you and to find our way back home today. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Wally's going to lead us in a couple of songs, and we invite you to go to any one of these tables throughout the room and share in this sacred meal together. We invite you to find someone who's wearing a blue lanyard and hand them that little card that you filled out today. Let them pray for you so we can contact you this week. You can find your way back to God. It just takes a step or two. You can take that step today. Let's stand and sing together.